Welcome to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast, the fifth in our series keeping you informed about the impacts of COVID-19. Listen to KPMG specialists in financial reporting discuss the impact of the economic slowdown on financial assets.
Welcome to this episode of KPMG's Financial Reporting Podcast, focusing on the impact of COVID-19 on financial assets, including impacts on loans, receivables, and investments. Managing financial assets during the pandemic has big implications for solvency, lending relationships, and the future of financial institutions and those that depend on them. I'm Brian Fields, a partner at KPMG, and in this podcast, we've gathered some of our specialists to talk about the impact of COVID-related declines in economic activity on financial assets. We recently released a related podcast focused on non-financial assets. With me today are three of our top professionals from KPMG, Lisa Blackburn, Joe Bilecki, and Mark Northern. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll talk about key questions we've received about accounting for the impact of the pandemic on financial assets, including questions related to the current expected credit losses accounting standard, or CECL, which many companies just adopted in the first quarter. Oh, and we're still recording from our houses in lockdown. If you hear my three kids fighting with each other in the background, cabin fever may be starting to set in. Joe, let's get this kicked off. Can you give us a big picture view of the impacts of the lockdowns on financial assets? What do we see so far?
Well, obviously the stay-at-home orders and closing of non-essential businesses have had some rather significant economic effects. By March 31st, the national unemployment level exceeded 10%, a level not seen since the Great Recession. As of today, unemployment stands at about twice that level and is projected to reach Great Depression levels of about 25% during Q2. Another important metric for measuring economic stability is change in GDP. Through 2019, GDP growth held at about 2 to 3%, which is pretty good. By comparison, despite no COVID impact in January or February, GDP growth for the first quarter of 2020 was negative, a shrinking of the economy by about 5%. Projections for Q2 are even more severe. Estimates range from about -15% to -25%. We have also seen related disruptions in the equity markets and in the fact that credit spreads have widened, depressing the fair value of those assets. These are clearly a reflection of the closing of many businesses, which are not able to, and in many cases not permitted to, stay open while the stay-at-home orders are in effect. Some industries, like the travel industry, are particularly hard hit. And obviously, it is also important to understand that COVID is a global phenomenon, a pandemic in its truest sense. What we are seeing is a global economic disruption. With all of these changes in economic conditions, it's pretty obvious that a significant impact to financial assets would be expected. Even worse, for many large public companies, the timing happens to coincide with the required implementation of a new accounting standard, which governs the way credit losses are estimated and presented in financial statements. The current expected credit losses, or CECL standard, which explicitly requires incorporation of an economic forecast. This has brought about a few interesting observations. First, what we are seeing in the published financials. We did see a significant increase in allowance, both in those filing under the old incurred loss accounting standard and those filing under CECL. Among those filing under the old standard, we generally saw increases of about 10 to 25%. We saw a larger impact on those financial statements filed with adoption of the CECL accounting rules, where we observed an increase of 25 to 40% was pretty common. More importantly, here's what we're not seeing. Generally, allowance estimates at Q1 do not reflect loss levels seen in the Great Recession, despite forecasts of even higher unemployment and a more significant decrease in GDP. It seems that this shows an optimism about the current economic situation, or perhaps fears of overreacting by allocating too high an allowance at 331 when the nature of this recession is not yet fully understood. There is a point of view that much of this unemployment is mandated by the stay-at-home order and will quickly recover once that order is lifted. Additional consideration is given to the stimulus package provided in the CARES Act. For example, the stimulus checks and incremental unemployment benefits act to offset the risk reflected in the unemployment rate, as many unemployed borrowers may still have sufficient cash flows to make payments on their debts. So while we saw large provisions in Q1, This optimism could lead to additional large provisions in Q2 and beyond as the depth of this recession's impacts become clearer and the efficacy of the stimulus becomes known. So, Brian, all in, the impact of COVID-19 is that it has definitely made estimating losses on financial assets more difficult this quarter and probably for the rest of the year.
Yeah, Joe, I have to say those unemployment numbers are astounding, and the number of moving parts here is confounding. Companies are going to need to figure out their estimated lifetime credit losses in an environment with so much uncertainty. Will it be a V-U or L-shaped recovery? When will the lockdowns end? How are companies approaching those tough questions, those tough forecasts required by this new standard?
I think I should start by acknowledging that most companies who have implemented CECL have avoided the difficult challenge of creating an economic forecast by sourcing their forecast from a third-party vendor. In general, only those institutions large enough to have teams of in-house economists have even attempted to generate their own forecasts. Still, forecasting has definitely presented many challenges at Q1. First, it has caused significant stress on practices put in place, which assume that information which is only slightly aged is materially consistent at the balance sheet date. Typically, economic forecasts come out mid-month, and they're based on data as of the end of the previous month. So for a March 31st estimate, you might expect to use a forecast published mid-March based on data as of the end of February. The pace of change in Q1 was so significant, so unprecedented, that many had to update their forecasts or make qualitative adjustments to reflect the actual expectations as of March 31st. As expectations continued to change through April, this brought up questions of whether it was necessary or better to use the April forecast to reflect the March estimate. Second, the uncertainty in the economic situation has made many second-guess their original framework for incorporating a forecast under CECL. For some who had determined that it was sufficient to use just one forecast scenario, we saw consideration of moving to a multiple scenario approach in order to better reflect the uncertainty in the forecasts. For others who had already decided to use a multiple scenario approach, we saw a reconsideration of the weighting of those scenarios, with a tendency to push additional weight to the tail scenarios. Let me explain that a little bit further. When combining multiple forecasts, the most likely scenario, often called the baseline scenario, is typically given a very high weighting, while an upside and downside scenario are given lesser weight in the calculation. So, an example of this change would be shifting from an 80% weighting to your baseline scenario, with a 10% weighting to both upside and downside scenarios, to something with more weight given to the upside and downside, like 40% to the baseline scenario, with 30% each to the upside and downside. This type of change could have a significant impact on the allowance estimate, as the negative impact of the downside scenario is typically more than offsetting the positive impact of the upside scenario, the effect is usually a higher allowance estimate. Finally, I think that it has become absolutely critical to understand the nature of economic forecasts as part of your governance controls. To be clear, this was always important. But the difference between various forecasts observed at March month end is extreme, and that creates a heightened need to be able to articulate the key assumptions underlying those forecasts and explain the impact of those assumptions on your loss estimate, both in written disclosures and in investor calls, etc. So those are really the biggest challenges we saw at Q1 in terms of integrating forecasts.
Yeah, I agree, Joe. Those are definitely some really big challenges there. I'll just add, I think it's worth mentioning that an economic forecast is just one of the assumptions, although, I mean, it's a really important assumption. It's just one of the assumptions that goes into a CECL estimate. And companies do need to revisit all of their assumptions every period. Now, that means that companies that just adopted CECL on January 1st need to immediately rethink everything, such as whether they're using the right historical loss data, whether to change the length of their forecast period, and whether to change their reversion method. Now, bear in mind that assumptions generally have some degree of interconnectedness so that a change in one may warrant a change in another. Like, for example, if you change your forecast or your forecast period, it might also be appropriate for you to use different historical loss data or to use a different method to revert to that historical loss data. Joe, you also mentioned earlier that the pandemic, although being global, hasn't necessarily had the same effect across the board. like different industries have been affected differently, and maybe different geographies have been affected differently. A lender might need to change how it segments its loan portfolio also to reflect those differences.
Okay, so we've got a major accounting standard being implemented in the fog of a major crisis. Changes are being made to the accounting, but the business environment is also changing at warp speed. For instance, I know lenders have granted accommodations to many borrowers. Lisa, what kind of changes are we seeing?
Well, Brian, in this environment, lenders are being encouraged, and in some cases even required, to modify loans, especially through providing forbearances, which are just payment deferrals. Now, there's no one program for how those deferred payments will be made up. Sometimes the missed payments will be tacked on to the end of a loan's life. Sometimes the borrower might have to make them up over a few months after the deferral period. Sometimes the missed payments might be added to the loan's balance, and then the loan gets re-amortized to change the payment amount. Those are all just examples. And we are seeing a bit of diversity, including between different loan types. The banking regulators and the CFPB are among those that are encouraging the loan modifications. In their view, if a borrower is having short-term problems due to COVID, then a short-term modification like a payment holiday is essentially a win-win situation. The borrower's short-term cash flow pressures are eased, and that in turn increases the chances that the borrower will ultimately be able to repay the bank everything that it owes. You know, and perhaps that is a win-win situation, but modifications do add some complexity to a lender's loss estimation process. So to help them out with that, Congress and the banking regulators have provided them with some accommodations to help ease the burden of dealing with the modifications.
Interesting. Can you tell us more about those accommodations?
Sure, Brian. The accommodations relate to determining whether a loan modification is a troubled debt restructuring, which we refer to as a TDR. You might wonder, why does it even matter whether a modification is a TDR? Well, it matters because there are different accounting requirements for TDRs versus non-TDRs, especially when you're estimating credit losses. And although there are some differences, both CECL and the old incurred loss standard treat TDRs differently than non-TDRs, so having some relief from TDR accounting is important for all lenders, whether or not they're applying CECL. And that relief comes from two different accommodations that allow lenders to not apply TDR accounting for loan modifications that are related to COVID. One source of those accommodations is the CARES Act, and the other is an interagency statement that the banking regulators issued. So let's start with the CARES Act. The CARES Act allows financial institutions to choose not to account for certain modifications as TDRs. It applies to modifications such as forbearances, interest rate modifications, repayment plans, and other arrangements that are like that that defer or delay payments. Now, for those types of arrangements, the CARES Act guidance is available as long as the borrower was current on December 31st and the modification was executed during a specified window of time. The window opened up on March 1st, and it will close on either December 31st or 60 days after the end of the national emergency, whichever comes first. So the window is still open, and we're not sure yet when it will close. Importantly, the CARES Act accommodation is only available for financial institutions. Now, in contrast, the interagency statement guidance is available for all lenders. So let's move over to that guidance. The banking regulators developed an approach that simplifies determining whether a modification is a TDR. The reason that all lenders can apply this approach is that it's an interpretation of how to apply GAAP rather than just an ability to not apply GAAP. In fact, the banking regulators consulted with the FASB staff when they were developing this approach, and the FASB staff concurred with the approach. Under the interagency statement guidance that the banking regulators developed, a COVID-related modification is not a TDR if it meets just two conditions. First, the modification needs to be a short-term modification, like a six-month payment deferral or a fee waiver or an extension. And then second, the borrower needs to be current when the lender's loan modification program was implemented. Now, earlier I mentioned that the reason for these accommodations from TDR accounting was because there are different accounting requirements for TDRs versus non-TDRs. But just because a loan modification isn't a TDR doesn't mean it should be ignored in a lender's allowance process. A lender does need to consider whether a modification itself points to increased credit risk that should still be reflected in the allowance.
Thanks, Lisa. That's a great breakdown of what's available. But what does it all mean from a practical perspective? Mark, how helpful is this to financial institutions?
Brian, I think financial institutions are finding this very helpful. And, most financial institutions, I think, are already taking advantage of these accommodations. So I think we can point to three real benefits from this, a couple of which Lisa's already mentioned. So if a modification is not a TDR, then an entity would not need to measure the direct effect of the modification in its allowance for credit losses. So under the TDR guidance, typically you'd need to measure the difference. If you had a payment deferral, you would need to measure the difference between two net present value measurements in order to calculate an allowance effect. So with so many of these modifications now not being treated as TDRs, it alleviates that. Lisa also mentioned credit risk mitigation. So deferring these payments makes sense from a credit risk perspective because it makes it more likely that borrowers are going to be able to make payments because the payments are going to be deferred until they hopefully have the wherewithal to make those payments. But I think the real reason this was granted is there's real operational relief when it comes to applying these accounting requirements. The TDR evaluation now is much easier. In the past, you had to evaluate a number of different considerations about whether the borrower is experiencing financial difficulty and whether the lender had provided a concession. But now it can be more straightforward with these accommodations. So, for example, you may need to consider only, was the borrower affected by COVID-19? What's the length and type of modification? And whether the loan was 30 or more days past due at certain dates. That's a much easier evaluation. And when you have a high volume of modifications, like a lot of financial institutions have right now, it makes a big difference.
Okay, got it. So there's a lot to deal with here. And for public companies, it has to happen very quickly. Joe, what kinds of tips do we have for companies trying to get this all done?
There are several important things to think about as we head towards what I expect to be even more difficult estimates in quarterly reporting for the rest of this year. Financial statement preparers should consider that since loans which may have otherwise had charge-offs may not be charged off during Q2 and Q3 due to the modifications, these are building up on your balance sheet, and that needs to be reflected as an increase to the allowance. The accommodations which have eased the operational burden, as Mark mentioned, around modifications, do not mean that the related credit risk does not have to be measured. The COVID-related modifications will have to be tracked as an important data point in estimating losses in future periods. It will have to be understood that modified loans, even though not being reported as delinquent, will have a similar credit profile to delinquent loans. We will need to consider expectations about the cure rate, the rate at which these loans are expected to return to paying status. This will have to be considered for these loans as a separate segment with a distinct risk profile. An important consideration will be that this cure rate will be different from your typical cure rate on modifications, and it should align with the economic forecast. For example, it would not make sense to estimate 100% cure rate if your forecast says that unemployment will still be above 10% going into 2021. On the other hand, if your forecast suggests that 50% of the increased unemployment at the balance sheet date will return to employed status by year end, perhaps that is a strong argument for assuming a 50% cure rate. One thing that's not yet on everyone's radar, this could also affect accrued interest receivable, as related interest may not be reversed timely due to those modifications. This would actually have to be reflected as an allowance where none was previously required due to the fact that you would normally expect accrued interest receivable to be reversed timely. Another important factor is to stress the importance of the governance controls in the process covering each quarter's estimate. As the environment is broken down to unprecedented levels of unemployment And given the uncertainty surrounding the effectiveness of the stimulus program, models are expected to be less effective or precise, and it will be absolutely critical to incorporate a significant amount of judgment in the estimate of allowance each quarter for at least the rest of this year. Higher levels of judgment require more proactive and informed governance controls. I expect that it will be more important than ever for executives to be involved in challenging the estimates and asking the question, how does this estimate make sense in light of the economic forecast and our historical experience? Lisa, I believe you had some additional thoughts on the importance of data.
Yeah, I'll add one thought to that, Joe. If a company wants to make good decisions, it needs to have good information on which to base those decisions. Now, that's true for making business decisions like how to manage credit risk. And it's also important for making decisions about estimating loss reserves. So it will be important for lenders to make sure they're capturing the relevant data that they need to make decisions and that they have good controls over making sure that data is reliable.
Thanks, Lisa. That's all really helpful, but let's turn to some other assets. What other financial assets are impacted by the crisis? What should folks look out for beyond CECL?
Yeah, my own 401k has turned into the incredible shrinking retirement account. And similarly, companies have watched the value of their investment portfolios plummet over the last couple of months. And those declines affect a company's financials differently for equities versus debt securities. So let's start with equities. Most equities are carried at fair value. However, if they don't have a market value that's readily determinable, a company can actually choose to carry those equities at cost as adjusted for impairments. Now, when times are good, a company can usually qualitatively determine that there's not impairment without having to do a full fair value estimate. But in this environment, investors won't be able to do that. Instead, they'll have to do a full fair value calculation. Now, ironically, the whole point of doing a cost measurement basis was to avoid estimating fair value when it's hard to do that. But now, those estimates will not only need to be made, but they'll need to be made in an environment where it's especially challenging to estimate fair value. Now let's switch gears to debt securities. There are a number of potential issues for debt securities, but I'm just going to focus on a couple. So first, a company's plans for how it's managing its investment portfolio may change. So for example, a company might now plan to sell a security that originally it planned to hold until the security matured. Alternatively, a company that had planned to sell a security in the short term might find that there's no longer a liquid market for that sale to occur. Now, reclassifications involving the trading category and HTM category generally are expected to be fairly rare. And further, sales of HTM securities usually taint the remaining HTM portfolio. However, we believe that some sales or transfers that are being caused by the pandemic may actually be acceptable without all the negative accounting consequences, just depending on the specific facts and circumstances. Now, there's also a related issue for available-for-sale securities. Some of the reasons that are driving a company to sell an HTM security might also cause a company to sell an AFS security that's underwater before its value has recovered. Or the company might now believe it's more likely than not that it will be required to sell an underwater AFS security before its value has recovered. And in those cases, a full write-down to fair value, their earnings, needs to be taken. Mark, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, Lisa, most of the discussion so far today has been about financial institutions or other entities that have made debt or equity investments. But there is an impact as well to commercial companies that just have trade receivables as a result of revenue transactions. And there are some different considerations for those entities and for trade receivables, the biggest of which is if you have a situation where an entity has trade receivables and they make a determination that they're not going to collect all amounts due, it's really necessary to consider the interaction with the revenue standard and make a determination about the reason that all amounts are not going to be collected. And is that a credit loss, which would be recorded under the CECL standard? Or is that a price concession that would be dealt with under the revenue standard? If a company determines that it really is a credit loss, then those entities will need to consider whether in this current economic situation, it's warranted to have an adjustment to the company's historical loss rates that are often used to measure bad debt reserves. A lot of entities we know have concluded that things like economic forecasts or even the impact of the CECL standard overall may not have an would not be expected to have an immaterial impact. And now, with this environment, those assumptions may need to be revisited. If a company determines that an adjustment to loss rates is necessary, we get a lot of questions about what should be considered in adjusting those loss rates, especially in this particularly challenging time. And I think what I would tell people is the approach really depends on the facts and circumstances and the nature of the trade receivables portfolio. But to different degrees, entities should be considering three things. Historical credit losses during previous economic downturns, collection experience during this pandemic thus far, and of course, Brian, there's no substitute for an entity's knowledge of the financial conditions of their customers, especially when they have some individually large customers.
Those are great reminders, Mark, that this affects all sorts of companies, not just banks. And there's lots of accounting models in play. Mark, I imagine that investors and other financial statement users are going to have to sort through all this information. Do you have any tips for CFOs and controllers about a communication strategy?
Sure, Brian. I mean, I think, you know, my biggest takeaway from this discussion today is that profit and loss amounts related to financial instruments are going to be significantly impacted by an entity's judgments and estimates. And those judgments and estimates are being made at a time that obviously involves unprecedented uncertainty. So as a result, investors are going to want to know more than the amount of the impairment recorded. They're going to want to know what assumptions were underlying those estimates and the impact of those assumptions, especially with respect to assumptions about future economic conditions. For example, in applying the CECL standard, did a company consider multiple economic scenarios? Did they consider a single scenario? What were those scenarios? I think this is going to be important information for investors to have a chance to compare the results across different entities just because of the impact that those assumptions can have on the related financial statement measurements. So with respect to the GAAP financial statements, the CECL standard, for example, has some disclosure requirements that are easy to either overlook or provide boilerplate disclosure, like a discussion of the factors that influence management's judgment about the allowance for credit losses. There's not going to be a more important time to make sure that the disclosure that's provided in response to that requirement is meaningful and can be readily understood by investors. And then, of course, for public companies, disclosures extend to other elements of the SEC filings like MD&A, where, as we all know, different types of information can be provided. And in all those areas, I think financial leaders of a number of companies will need to think about effective communications on the judgments and the estimates, and the best way to articulate that to investors who want to know specifically what impact did COVID-19 have on those estimates and on an entity's financial results.
Thanks, Mark. That's a great place to close. Many companies just adopted a new credit losses standard that requires estimating lifetime credit losses. Now accountants are applying many of that new standard's provisions for the first time during an unprecedented health emergency and economic crisis. Key action items for financial assets include taking an inventory of financial assets impacted by the economic slowdown, connecting with the right people in the business to make sure the company's plans and projections are refreshed and up to date, evaluating the accounting impact of economic conditions and management plans, including the availability of any accounting elections, and crafting the right disclosures to capture the impacts in accounting, including points of uncertainty. Financial institutions have a big job to do in this crisis. Credit and cash are the lifeblood that keep American business running. Banks need to manage their own positions while providing solvency to the wider financial system. And whether you are on the new credit standard or the old, there's work for accountants to do in preparing clear, timely, and accurate financial information for investors during the coronavirus storm. Thanks again to Lisa, Mark, and Joe for your remarks. Here at KPMG, our goal is keeping you informed on the latest developments that may impact your financial reporting during this unusual time. Stay safe and stay tuned for more.
Thanks for listening to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. For our hot topics on the financial impacts of COVID-19, including considerations for financial assets, and more news on responding with resilience and readiness, please go to our website, read.kpmg.us/coronavirus. Stay safe and stay tuned for more on this important topic.